From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. On today's show, what the recent SAG-AFTRA elections could mean for the future of the Film, TV, and Radio Union, then Renee Zellweger returns to the screen as Judy Garland, as the brilliant but troubled entertainer stages a late career comeback.
She was able to overcome all of this mess and still perform and still give so much to her audiences. And boy, she still delivered.
And the veteran R&B singer who transformed a 60s hippie anthem into a soulful ballad. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. It's Friday and time for our end-of-the-week check-in with Variety on the latest entertainment industry news. And joining us is Dave McNary, who covers labor and film. So, Dave, you've been covering the recent SAG-AFTRA elections. That union has some 160,000 members, primarily TV and film actors. Actress Gabrielle Carteris was reelected as president, but that doesn't necessarily mean smooth sailing ahead.
That's correct. It was pretty contentious, and these elections tend to get fairly heated anyhow. And I think that's because the turnout, the participation rates are so low. They're only between 20% and 30%. So that actually magnifies the importance of the individual voters. In this case, the fundamental difference between the two sort of ruling factions at SAG-AFTRA is that Gabrielle Carteris's side, which calls itself Unite for Strength, they tend to take a more pragmatic approach and try and be as realistic as possible about what they're trying to achieve in negotiations. The membership first side, which tends to be more progressive, is pushing for taking a much more aggressive stance at the bargaining table and for more disclosure of what's going on, particularly in terms of bargaining proposals to the membership.
Right. So Matthew Modine represents the membership first faction of the union. So what does this mean going forward? Could this mean more internal strife within the union? Could it mean greater checks and balances? What's happening here?
I would say more internal strife is really a given. These two sides have been at each other for 20 years, and it's mostly been the Unite for Strength side that's been in charge, but the membership first people made some real gains this time, even though Modine didn't win. They got a lot of seats, 12 of the 16 that were open, representing Los Angeles, and some high-profile people such as Jennifer Beals, Ed Asner, and Nev Campbell are going to be on the board.
We're speaking with Dave McNary from Variety about the recent SAG-AFTRA elections. So, Dave, what are some of the fundamental differences between these two sides within the union? You kind of touched on it, but could you elaborate a bit more?
The key thing is a willingness to go on strike, and that hasn't happened at SAG or AFTRA for a long time. It did happen in the year 2000 in the advertising industry strike, where they stayed out for 6 months and they did pretty well in terms of the gains that they were able to get. The current leadership just has not shown an inclination to do that at all. They don't take strike authorization votes, and they don't really try to mobilize the membership on issues as they lead up to bargaining.
But with membership first leadership within the union, strike authorization could be more likely.
I'd say so. And there's a real wrinkle here this time. SAG-AFTRA signed a 3-year deal with Netflix, and that means that Netflix is not part of the sort of master contract that's going to be up for negotiation next year. It expires in June. So even if SAG-AFTRA did strike everyone that's covered under that, and that's the major networks and film studios, actors would be able to continue working for Netflix. So I think that gives SAG-AFTRA some leverage.
I see. Well, one of the first big items on Carteris's plate going forward is this possible partnership with the writers and directors guilds to bargain a master film and TV contract with the major studios. Can you explain a little bit about what's at stake there?
Yes, this is called pattern bargaining. So usually what happens is the directors go first, and that sort of sets the basic terms and conditions. That said, there are different issues for actors and writers. So the contracts aren't exactly the same, but they do tend to be bargained with the same kinds of issues on the table. And particularly now that streaming has become such a large part of the world of entertainment.
Wondering, with the SAG-AFTRA elections now behind us, knowing what the leadership is going to look like going forward in the short term, is that at all a predictor of how this potential deal might go with these major film studios over this other issue?
Getting Gabriel Carteris reelected is sort of a strong signal that the membership is okay with how she's been running things. And the board is now sort of in a position where that's difficult for them to ignore that mandate.
A lot of this conversation might seem pretty inside baseball for your casual listener. I'm wondering if you could make the case why they should care about something like this election. What does it mean to them?
It could mean that there's going to be some kind of delay in the network seasons. That could happen very easily. There could be some kind of disruption. 10 years ago, when the Writers Guild struck, a lot of series TV went off the air. On the other hand, since people watch so much product by streaming, and that threat of a strike may not have the same kind of impact.
Variety's Dave McNary covers labor and film. Dave, total pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
And we should note here that KPCC program hosts, news announcers, reporters, and some producers are members of the SAG-AFTRA union. You can read Dave McNary's reporting at Variety.com. The trade magazine has a big presence at the Telluride Film Festival, and so do we. John Horn is there, and coming up, you'll hear his interview with Renee Zellweger. She plays Judy Garland in a film that's premiering at the festival. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Renee Zellweger is at the Telluride Film Festival for the premiere of her new film, Judy, as in Judy Garland. Zellweger portrays the singer at a time late in her career, when Garland was battling demons on several fronts. The film was directed by Robert Gould. When she visited The Frame's makeshift studio in Telluride, Zellweger told John Horn about how she prepared to perform some of Garland's most celebrated songs live on set.
Somewhere along the line, I had decided, you know, defined myself as a person who was inconsistent and couldn't sing live. And I was a person who was who had a tiny voice and shouldn't try to sing big belter songs, and who would never perform live in front of living human beings because that would be a terrible idea. But I just sort of trusted the process and just started working, and started working with vocal coaches who had different techniques and who taught me different things. You know, it began with contorting my body to try and, you know, somehow make that sound come out, as terrible as it might have been.
Because
just to
there's
see.
So much reference. I mean, I think it's part of the that's part of the opportunity and problem, right? There are a lot of people who know exactly what she sounded like, which
yes.
gives you a foundation.
Yes.
But also becomes the basis of comparison.
Well, sure. And I tried not to think about that. And I'm still trying not to think about that. Because I know that that wasn't what Rupert was trying to achieve with this. It was more about her humanity. An opportunity to capture the essence of this extraordinary woman and contextualize the experiences of her life in that period of her life.
There was a fascinating review that we found of the original concerts in 1968 in The Observer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the critics said in part. It's a long review and there's lots of really interesting stuff. She doesn't really give a concert. She conducts a seance. She evokes pity and sorrow like no other superstar.
Wow.
So And that seems to fit really into the movie about what's going on in Judy's life at the time of this story. So how would you describe the chaos that is all around her and how that chaos starts to show itself on stage when she's performing?
I mean, this is her bliss. We're talking about performance and connecting with audiences, and obviously it's her gift, and it's also what she relies on for her freedom and financial stability and her ability to take care of herself. She was in debt, and she didn't have a home, a place to live. She was having difficulty finding work in the United States because her reputation was not one of great reliability. And then there's this addiction that we didn't, I guess, well, we understand a little bit more about these days, obviously, coupled with anxieties and, you know, just years and years and years of overworking this thing that you're supposed to take very great care of, which I've come to learn about this instrument that you can't just push and push and push. The chaos, I suppose, is just, you know, what you see on the outside is usually a manifestation of what's on the inside. And all of those things, one of those things that she was experiencing at the time would have been enough to break a person. And I think that that's what's so interesting about talking about this time in her life. It's not, I don't think that there's any shame in it. I think that it just really highlights how exceptional she was, that she was able to overcome all of this mess and still perform and still give so much to her audiences. And despite the abuse and the wear on her instrument, boy, she still delivered, you know? She still could hit those notes and break your heart like nobody, you know?
The other thing that I think is really interesting about the film is Judy Garland had addiction issues, but those addiction issues were started by Hollywood. Mm-hmm. That she was punished and treated in ways that were almost, I think, are inhumane in terms of the way the studio treated her, the way they talked about her weight, what she couldn't eat, how she had to be on medication, that the person that she became as an adult was really cast by the way that she was treated by the industry when she was a child.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that feels like a central idea to the film, that this is not a woman who is making choices in her own life. Those choices were made for her before she had any agency.
That's true. And obviously it's going to change your body chemistry and create a situation where you can't function without whatever it was that they were giving you to help you deliver on such a crazy schedule, you know. And that's another thing I think is interesting. It sort of puts in context that this was not a choice. This is not a person who wakes up in the morning and wants a handful of pills because she just doesn't feel like dealing with the day. This is a woman who would have seizures if she overslept and woke up having, you know, not having her medication. It's tragic in that respect. But again, when you look at what she was capable of in spite of all of that and the lack of understanding around her about what that means and what you might do to treat it as we better understand today.
We're at the Telluride Film Festival and we're talking with Renee Zellweger about her new film, Judy. What are the hardest scenes to do in this film? Not singing-wise. The hardest emotionally, hardest acting. Do you remember days that were really difficult? Because there's a lot of dark periods in Judy's life around this time, but she's really trying so hard to hold it all together and make it.
I was going to make a joke that it was really hot on that set in her hotel room wearing that coat. It was so hot in there that the camera equipment shut down. It just wouldn't roll anymore. The monitors were going all fuzzy. That was when they had to bring the air conditioner in. Not because everybody was dying, but because the camera equipment wouldn't work anymore. Okay, back to your question. Were difficult days. No, I didn't think of any of them as difficult. It was all joy. It was joy. I'm holding this microphone now with this cord, and it feels so familiar to me. And I don't know, remembering those days on the stage at the Hackney Empire with all the actors and the audience and the days we shared, and we laughed so much and shared stories about, you know, a lot of them whose parents had been at the shows and
meaning
things
the,
like
the
that.
Extras,
yes,
in the audience were children of people who had seen Judy play.
Yeah, and there were a couple of them who had been to the Talk of the Town and were sharing their stories. stories about it. I mean,
what did they say?
Cool.
That's fascinating.
Oh, just that it was magnificent, or that she was really late and we waited until whatever hour and everybody was hammered by the time she got there because, you know, that's what happens.
No, and they would, and the, as the reviews indicated, people would yell at Judy. She would yell back. There was a lot of, I don't know if you call it give and take, heckling, but there was a lot going on. I want to ask you about your hiatus and about what that meant to you. You stopped acting for what, 5-6 years between 2010 and 2016. You studied writing. You co-created, wrote, and produced a show called Cinnamon Girl. Mm-hmm. What did you find that you were able to do when you stopped and looked back from a different perspective? How did it change your priorities? Mm-hmm. And did it give you a new way of looking at how you would manage your own career? Did it open a window in a way?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. To step away from something, you know, obviously gives you perspective. And I hadn't realized how I had been putting myself last, that I said yes to everything because I'm so lucky, you know, I'm very blessed. And the people that I work with are extraordinarily gifted and kind. And so anytime someone would ask, the answer was yes. It was just across the board, yes. And I hadn't realized that in saying yes to everyone else, I was never saying yes to myself. And I won't do that anymore. And so that's a pretty boring takeaway. Pretty boring revelation. Sorry, everybody.
I don't think
everybody.
It's boring at all. I don't think it's boring at all because I think it's a fundamental issue in a lot of businesses, but certainly in Hollywood, where, especially as an actor, you never want to say no because you don't know what your next job is. And the entire industry is set around what's next and how you're going to move on. And that's contingent on everybody's compensation, agents, lawyers, managers. And that the idea of saying no to something is almost ingrained in you that that's something you shouldn't do. And before you know it, you don't know what it is you're saying yes to because you haven't stopped.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's, I didn't look at it that way.
Okay, how did you look at it?
I didn't say no because of, you know, my friends. I said yes a lot of times because of the creative opportunities and the people that I would have the chance to work with. I'd sit with, you know, Rob Marshall and think, oh my gosh, I just have to know him. I have to know him. And
this is the director of Chicago, we should say.
Yes. And the creative experience of a lifetime is going to be the cherry on top, you know. But when it became time to stop and step away for a second, you know, I wasn't worried about it at all. I knew that there would be other creative opportunities and other people that I would want to work with in a different capacity in a quieter way.
Let me ask this last question. How would you define what it is that you get excited about now? Because it could be acting, could be writing, could be producing. What are the stories that speak to you?
Oh, wow. Good's good. You know, if it makes me laugh out loud, I love things that obviously push the conversation in some way if it's an important issue. And I think it's one of the best ways to move people, this medium, you know. So that excites me. I love going to movies. You know, I love it. Change my perspective every time. Every time. So I just, I don't know, blessed to be part of it, honestly, to get to do this for a living in any capacity. Be here in Telluride eating your biscuits. I mean, life couldn't be better, except if your dog was here and my dogs were here. Then life could be better.
We'll get them together. Renee, thanks so much for coming on the
Thank
show.
Thank you. It was fun to talk to you.
And in case you're wondering about those biscuits that Zellweger was referring to, they're John Horn's specialty, and sometimes the Frame crew gets to enjoy them too. Coming up on the Frame, Flower Power gets a soulful twist from a veteran R&B singer. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. If you've seen The Last Black Man in San Francisco, you might have been struck by the film's powerful reimagining of a famous hippie anthem.
If you're going to San Francisco.
That singer, Michael Marshall, also happens to be the original vocalist on a hit song from the 1990s that makes a prominent appearance in another of this summer's most talked about movie releases, Jordan Peele's Us. The Frame contributor Chloe Veltman recently met up with Marshall in the Bay Area. After fighting for recognition for decades, Veltman says the R&B singer might now be starting to get his due.
My name is Michael Marshall, a.k.a. Mike Measy. What I'm gonna do right now is tell you a little bit about me.
In his autobiographical song, Who Is He?, Michael Marshall sings repeatedly about feeling invisible. The R&B singer has collaborated with renowned hip-hop artists such as E-40, San Quinn and The Loonies over a career spanning more than three decades. He's made several hits, and his work has been featured in two prominent movies this summer. But the 53-year-old says his efforts largely still go unheralded.
They all have my voice in their house, in their car, on their phone, somewhere. Everybody knows me, they just don't know who I am.
All across the nation, such a strange vibration.
Marshall's performance of this song from the movie The Last Black Man in San Francisco has raised his profile.
I've heard a lot of people say that I never even knew I liked that song until I heard this version.
LA-based composer Emil Mosseri wrote the score for The Last Black Man and is among a growing group of industry insiders who've embraced Marshall's vocal gift. Mosseri says the film's director, Joe Talbot, was a longtime fan of Marshall's when he tapped the singer to cover San Francisco, Be Sure to Wear Flowers in Your Hair in the movie.
Everybody was in tears the first time they heard him sing it. It was just this incredible performance. They knew right away that they had gold.
Sitting in the kitchen of a friend's house near Berkeley on a recent morning, Marshall, who's tall, goateed, and loosely dressed in sweats and spectacles, tells me he had no trouble reworking John Phillips and Scott McKenzie's 1967 hit. He's covered other songs by white artists over the years, like Gilbert O'Sullivan's Alone Again, Naturally. Marshall says he received an immersion in white hippie culture as an undergrad at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo.
I'm pretty good singing white people's covers. Unsoul music, non-soul music, I'm good at singing that.
Marshall started out performing in high school talent shows. It was not long after graduating from Berkeley High that he achieved his first success as a member of the band Timex Social Club with a track called Rumors in 1986. The song soared up the charts in several countries, including the US and UK. Marshall's career could have taken off at that point, but instead, things in his life started to derail.
I was not prepared. So I'm bumping my head, skinning my knees at every turn.
Marshall says his troubles started after he passed up a 10-year record deal on the back of the rumor's success. The singer says he feared being locked in.
We read all the stories about how artists were being treated. Prince was complaining. Michael Jackson was complaining.
He then watched helplessly as his former producer, Jay King, formed a new band, Club Nouveau, and used some of Timex Social Club's musical ideas to fuel new hits.
Why you treat me so bad?
Like Why You Treat Me So Bad from 1987. Marshall partly blames himself for his lack of business sense, but he says King and others swindled him out of royalties and credit, leading him down a long, self-destructive path of bitterness and drug abuse.
Yeah, it was bad. I was literally trying to kill myself.
I reached Jay King on the phone at his office in Sacramento. The music producer blames the singer's misfortunes on his drug habit, but he still respects the man's golden voice.
Even with all the abuse that he's put on his voice, it's so beautiful and resonant that even he can't destroy it.
For more than two decades, Marshall was lost to crack cocaine. But he still managed to release music once in a while, like the memorable vocal hook on the 1995 Loonies weed anthem, I Got Five On It. Marshall says for years he wasn't properly credited or compensated for that song either.
People who knew me would say, oh, that's Mike and all that, but the radio wasn't saying my name. And the artists were having shows and not inviting me.
Starting around 2004, with the help of his wife, April, Marshall managed to get clean and gradually sorted out his business affairs. Now he says the royalty checks are starting to flow in. He's licensed some uses of I Got Five On It, and he also has some new projects in mind, like a cover album.
There's a cover of a Simply Red song I want to do.
Which one?
It should have been me. at this moment in time? Is it in your mind at all? Sunrise.
Oh, yeah.
Sunrise.
And he wants to revamp the alphabet song that kids learn in school.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Marshall says he hopes children will find his version of the classic ditty more memorable.
D-U-V, W-X-Y-Z.
For The Frame, I'm Chloe Veltman.
Man, I'm alone again, naturally.
And that's it for this week. Make sure to tune in Saturday at 2 p.m. for The Frame Weekend. You can also get that show and every one of our daily episodes by subscribing to our podcast. The Frame is produced by Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Robert Garova, with help this week from Emily Henderson. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentino Rivera is the show's engineer. The opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here on Tuesday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great and a safe Labor Day weekend.